Good morning, and welcome to the WGTD Radio Theater's live broadcast from the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. I'm your program host, Cameron Spencer. Today is our annual Halloween program, and we are very pleased that our very own Vincent Price will be narrating today's show. Before we begin our journey into the world of Halloween, let me remind you that support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha law firm of Aaliyah, Dume, Dunn, and McTernan, and also the not-for-profit Brown Ulster Performing Arts Foundation, located in Salem, Wisconsin. And now, it's with a great deal of pleasure, but perhaps just a little bit of hesitation, that I introduce our narrator for today's program, Mr. Vincent Price.
Thank you for your somewhat hesitant introduction. Good morning and welcome. I am Vincent Price, and today the 91.1 players shall entertain us with their splendid interpretations of the works of Edgar Allan Poe, Ambrose Bierce, and Barbara Tyler. Edgar Allan Poe. I will have the honor in just a bit to read Poe's The Telltale Heart. I believe Poe is great because he is independent of cheap attractions. His verse sometimes alarms and puzzles the reader by fainting with its own beauty, but the beauty is never the beauty of the flesh. You never say to him, as you have to say uneasily to so many modern artists, "Yes, my friend, but these are things that men and women should live and not write about." Literature is not a keyhole for people with starved affections to peep through at the banquets of the body. It is life itself. But I am digressing. We begin today's journey into the macabre with a delicious short story by Ambrose Bierce. A place named the Manton House is the main setting for the middle toe of the right foot. The Manton House was haunted. No. It wasn't a question, it was a fact. The place was haunted and people knew it was true. As with many haunted places, the Manton House had a dark past. Given the past of the place, what happened when four men arrived at the house one evening? What fate befell those men? Ambrose Bierce, storyteller of more than a century ago, dabbled very often in stories about ghosts. Of those not involving soldiers, this is one of the better ones. The plot is a familiar one, recycled in various Bierce stories. It starts with a duel, a bet of sorts to stay in a haunted house, and ends up a tragic joke. Bierce was also the author of the better-known short story An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is the story of a Confederate sympathizer condemned to death by hanging from Owl Creek Bridge. And now, The Middle Toe of the Right Foot by Ambrose Bierce. I know you will enjoy it as much as I do.
It is a well-known that the old Manton House is haunted. In all the rural district nearabout, and even the town of Marshall, a mile away, not one person of unbiased mind entertains a doubt of it. Incredulity is confined to those opinionated persons who will be called cranks as soon as the useful word shall have penetrated the intellectual domain of the Marshall Advance. The evidence that the house is haunted is of two kinds. The testimony of the disinterested witness who have had ocular proof, and that of the house itself. The former may be disregarded and ruled out as any of the various grounds of objection which may be urged against it by the ingenious, but facts within the observation of all are material and controlling. In the first place, the Manton House has been unoccupied by mortals for more than 10 years, and with its outbuildings is slowly falling into decay, a circumstance which, in itself, the judicious will hardly venture to ignore. It stands a little way off the loneliest reach of the Marshall and Harrison Road. in an opening which was once a farm and is still disfigured with strips of rotting fence and half covered with brambles overrunning a stony and sterile soil long unacquainted with the plow.
The house itself is in tolerably good condition, though badly weather-stained and in dire need of attention from the glazier. The small male population of the region have attested in the manner of its kind its disapproval of dwelling without dwellers. It is two stories in height, nearly square, its front pierced by a single doorway flanked on each side by a window boarded up to the very top. Corresponding windows above, not protected, serve to admit light and rain to the rooms of the upper floor. Grass and weeds grow pretty rankly all about, and a few shade trees, somewhat the worse for wind, and leaning all in one direction, seem to be making a concerted effort to run away. In short, as the Marshall town humorist explained in the columns of the Advance, the proposition that the Manton house is badly haunted is the only logical conclusion from the premises. The fact that in this dwelling Mr. Manton thought it expedient one night, some 10 years ago, to rise and cut the throats of his wife and two small children, removing at once to another part of the country, has no doubt done its share in directing public attention to the fitness of the place for supernatural phenomena. To this house one summer evening came four men in a wagon. Three of them promptly alighted, and the one who had been driving hitched the team to the only remaining post of what had been a fence. The fourth remained seated in the wagon. "Come," said one of the companions, approaching him, while the others moved away in the direction of the dwelling. "This is the place."
The man addressed did not move. "By God," he said harshly, "this is a trick, and it looks to me as if you were in it."
"Perhaps I am," the other said, looking him straight in the face and speaking in a tone which had something of contempt in it. "You will remember, however, that the choice of place was with your own assent left to the other side. Of course, if you're afraid of spooks..."
"I'm afraid of nothing,"
the man interrupted with another oath and sprang to the ground. The two then joined the others at the door, which one of them had already opened with some difficulty caused by rust of lock and hinge. All entered. Inside, it was dark, but the man who had unlocked the door produced a candle and matches and made a light. He then unlocked a door on their right as they stood in the passage. This gave them entrance to a large square room that the candle but dimly lighted.
The floor had a thick carpeting of dust, which partly muffled their footfalls. Cobwebs were in the angles of the walls and depended from the ceiling like strips of rotting lace, making undulatory movements in the disturbed air. The room had two windows in adjoining sides, but from neither could anything be seen except the rough inner surface of the boards, a few inches from the glass. There was no fireplace, no furniture, there was nothing besides the cobwebs and the dust. The four men were the only objects there which were not a part of the structure. Strange enough they looked in the yellow light of the candle. The one who had so reluctantly alighted was especially spectacular. He might have been called sensational. He was of middle age, heavily built, deep-chested and broad-shouldered. Looking at his figure, one would have said he had the strength of a giant, and his features that he would use it like a giant. He was clean-shaven, his hair rather closely cropped and gray. His low forehead was seamed with wrinkles above the eyes, and over the nose these became vertical. The heavy black brows followed the same law, saving the meeting only by an upward turn at what would otherwise have been the point of contact. Deeply sunken beneath these glowed in the obscure light a pair of eyes of uncertain color, but obviously enough too small. There was something forbidding in their expression, which was not bettered by their cruel mouth and wide jaw.
The nose was well enough, as noses go. One does not expect much of noses. All that was sinister in the man's face seemed accentuated by an unnatural pallor. He appeared altogether bloodless. The appearance of the other men was sufficiently commonplace. They were such persons as one meets and forgets that he met. All were younger than the man described, between whom and the eldest of the others, who stood apart, there was apparently no kindly feeling. They avoided looking at each other. Gentlemen, said the man holding the candle and keys, I believe everything is right. Are you ready, Mr. Rosser? The man standing apart from the group bowed and smiled. And you, Mr. Grossmith? The heavy man bowed and scowled. You will be pleased to remove your outer clothing.
The hats, coats, waistcoats, and neckwear were soon removed and thrown outside the door in the passage. The man with the candle now nodded, and the fourth man, he who had urged Grossmith to leave the wagon, produced from the pocket of his overcoat two long, murderous-looking bowie knives, which he drew now from their leather scabbards. They are exactly alike, he said, presenting one to each of the two principals, for by this time the dullest observer would have understood the nature of this meeting. It was to be a duel to the death. Each combatant took a knife, examined it critically near the candle, and tested the strength of the blade and handle across his lifted knee. Their persons were then searched in turn, each by the second of the other. If it is agreeable to you, Mr. Grossmith, said the man holding the light, you will place yourself in that corner. He indicated the angle of the room farthest from the door, whither Grossmith retired. His second parting from him with a grasp of the hand which had nothing of cordiality in it. In the angle nearest the door, Mr. Rosser stationed himself, and after a whispered consultation, his second left him, joining the other near the door. At that moment, the candle was suddenly extinguished, leaving all in profound darkness. This may have been done by a draught from the open door. Whatever the cause, the effect was startling.
Gentlemen, said a voice which sounded strangely unfamiliar in the altered condition affecting the relations of the senses. Gentlemen, you will not move until you hear the closing of the outer door. A sound of trampling ensued, then the closing of the inner door, and finally the outer one closed with a concussion which shook the entire building. A few minutes afterward, a belated farmer's boy met a light wagon which was being driven furiously toward the town of Marshall. He declared that behind the two figures on the front seat stood a third, with its hands upon the bowed shoulders of the others, who appeared to struggle vainly to free themselves from its grasp. This figure, unlike the others, was clad in white, and had undoubtedly boarded the wagon as it passed the haunted house. Had the lad could boast a considerable former experience with the supernatural thereabouts, his word had to wait justly due to the testimony of an expert.
The events that led up to this duel in the dark were simple enough. One evening, three young men of the town of Marshall were sitting in a quiet corner of the porch of the village hotel, smoking and discussing such matters as three educated young men of a southern village would naturally find interesting. Their names were King, Sancher, and Rosser. At a little distance, within easy hearing, but taking no part in the conversation, sat a fourth. He was a stranger to the others. They merely knew that on his arrival by the stagecoach that afternoon, he had written in the hotel register the name of Robert Grossmith. He had not been observed to speak to anyone except the hotel clerk. He seemed, indeed, singularly fond of his own company, or, as the personnel of the Advance expressed it, grossly addicted to evil associations. But then, it should be said in justice to the stranger that the personnel was himself of too convivial disposition fairly to judge one differently gifted, and had, moreover, experienced a slight rebuff in an effort at an interview. I hate any kind of deformity in a woman, said King, whether natural or acquired. I have a theory that any physical defect has its correlative mental and moral defect.
I infer, then, said Rosser gravely, that a lady lacking the moral advantage of a nose would find the struggle to become Mrs. King an arduous enterprise. Of course you may put it that way, was the reply, but seriously, I once threw over a most charming girl on learning quite accidentally that she had suffered amputation of a toe. My conduct was brutal, if you like, but if I had married that girl, I should have been miserable for life and should have made her so. Whereas, said Sancher, with a light laugh, by marrying a gentleman of more liberal views, she escaped with a parted throat. Ah, you know to whom I refer. Yes, she married Manton, but I don't know about his liberality. I'm not sure, but he cut her throat because he discovered that she lacked that excellent thing in woman, the middle toe of the right foot.
Look at that chap, said Rosser in a low voice, his eyes fixed upon the stranger. That chap was obviously listening intently to the conversation. Damn his impudence, muttered King. What ought we do? That's an easy one, Ross replied, rising. Sir, he continued, addressing the stranger, I think it would be better if you would remove your chair to the other end of the veranda. The presence of gentlemen is evidently an unfamiliar situation to you. The man sprang to his feet and strode forward with clenched fists, his face white with rage. All were now standing. Sancher stepped between the belligerents. You are hasty and unjust, he said to Rosser. This gentleman has done nothing to deserve such language. But Rosser would not withdraw a word. But by the custom of the country and the time, there could be by one outcome to the quarrel. I demand the satisfaction due to a gentleman, said the stranger, who had become more calm. I have not an acquaintance in this region. Perhaps you, sir, bowing to Sancher, will be kind enough to represent me in this matter.
Sancher accepted the trust. Somewhat reluctantly, it must be confessed, for the man's appearance and manner were not at all to his liking. King, who during the colloquy had hardly removed his eyes from the stranger's face and had not spoken a word, consented with a nod to act for Rosser. And the upshot of it was that, the principals having retired, a meeting was arranged for the next evening. The nature of the arrangement has been already disclosed. The duel with knives in a dark room was once a commoner feature of the southwestern life than it is likely to be again. How thin a veneering of chivalry covered the essential brutality of the code under which such encounters were possible, we shall see. In the blaze of a midsummer noonday, the old Manton house was hardly true to its traditions. It was of the earth, earthy. The sunshine caressed it warmly and affectionately, with evident disregard of its bad reputation. The grass greening all the expanse in its front seemed to grow, not rankly, but with a natural and joyous exuberance. And the weeds blossomed quite like plants, full of charming lights and shadows and populous with pleasant-voiced birds. The neglected shade trees no longer struggled to run away, but bent reverently beneath their burdens of sun and song. Even in the glassless upper windows was an expression of peace and contentment due to the light within. Over the stony fields, the visible heat danced with a lively tremor, incompatible with the gravity which is an attribute of the supernatural.
Such was the aspect under which the place presented itself to Sheriff Adams and two other men who had come out from Marshall to look at it. One of these men was Mr. King, the sheriff's deputy. The other, whose name was Brewer, was a brother of the late Mrs. Manton. Under a beneficent law of the state relating to property which has been for a certain period abandoned by an owner whose residence cannot be ascertained, the sheriff was legal custodian of the Manton farm and appurtenances thereunto belonging. His present visit was in mere perfunctory compliance with some order of a court in which Mr. Brewer had an action to get possession of the property as heir to his deceased sister. By a mere coincidence, the visit was made on the day after the night that Deputy King had unlocked the house for another and very different purpose. His presence now was not of his own choosing. He had been ordered to accompany his superior, and at the moment could think of nothing more prudent than simulated alacrity in obedience to the command. Carelessly opening the front door, which to his surprise was not locked, the sheriff was amazed to see, lying on the floor of the passage into which it opened, a confused heap of men's apparel. Examination showed it to consist of two hats and the same number of coats, waistcoats, and scarves, all in a remarkably good state of preservation, albeit somewhat defiled by the dust in which they lay. Mr. Brewer was equally astonished, but Mr. King's emotion is not of record.
With a new and lively interest in his own actions, the sheriff now unlatched and pushed open a door on the right, and the three entered. The room was apparently vacant. No. As their eyes became accustomed to the dimmer light, something was visible in the farthest angle of the wall. It was a human figure, that of a man, crouching close in the corner. Something in the attitude made the intruders halt when they had barely passed the threshold. The figure more and more clearly defined itself.
The man was upon one knee, his back in the angle of the wall, his shoulders elevated to the level of his ears, his hands before his face, palms outward, the fingers spread and crooked like claws. The face white, turned upward on the retracted neck, had an expression of unutterable fright. The mouth half open, the eyes incredibly expanded. He was stone dead. Yet with the exception of a Bowie knife, which had evidently fallen from his own hand, not another object was in the room. In thick dust that covered the floor were some confused footprints near the door and along the wall through which it opened. Along one of the adjoining walls, too, past the boarded-up windows, was the trail made by the man himself in reaching his corner. Instinctively approaching the body, the three men followed that trail. The sheriff grasped one of the outthrown arms. It was as rigid as iron, and the application of a gentle force rocked the entire body without altering the relation of its parts. Brewer paled with excitement, gazed intently into the distorted face. "God of mercy!" he suddenly cried. "It is Manton!"
"You are right," said King, with an evident attempt at calmness. "I knew Manton. He then wore a full beard and his hair long, but this is he. He might have added. I recognized him when he challenged Rosser. I told Rosser and Sancho who he was before we played him this horrible trick. When Rosser left this dark room at our heels, forgetting his outer clothing in the excitement and driving away with us in his shirt sleeves, all through the discreditable proceedings, we knew with whom we were dealing, murderer and coward that he was. But nothing of this did Mr. King say. With his better light, he was trying to penetrate the mystery of the man's death, that he had not once moved from the corner where he had been stationed, that his posture was that of neither attack nor defense, that he had dropped his weapon, that he had obviously perished of sheer horror of something that he saw. These were circumstances which Mr. King's disturbed intelligence could not rightly comprehend.
Groping in intellectual darkness for a clue to his maze of doubt, his gaze directed mechanically downward in the way of one who ponders momentous matters, fell upon something which there, in the light of day and in the presence of living companions, affected him with terror. In the dust of years that lay thick upon the floor, leading from the door by which they had entered straight across the room to within a yard of Manton's crouching corpse, were three parallel lines of footprints, light but definite impressions of bare feet. The outer ones were those of small children, the inner a woman's. From the point at which they ended, they did not return. They pointed all one way. Brewer, who had observed them at the same moment, was leaning forward in an attitude of rapture attention, horribly pale. "Look at that," he cried, pointing with both hands at the nearest print of a woman's right foot, where she had apparently stopped and stood. "The middle toe is missing. It was Gertrude."
Gertrude was the late Mrs. Manton, sister to Mr. Brewster.
The middle toe of the right foot was certainly a strange title for a story. The title becomes even stranger when the reader discovers that the short story is a ghost story. The author, Ambrose Bierce, was known for his dark writing, and this tale did not disappoint. The meaning behind the title only added another eerie layer to the story. We continue now with our WGTD Radio Theater's Halloween special and our oh-so-scary broadcast today. With a delightfully wicked and frightful story by Barb Tyler, member of the 91.1 Players and quite an accomplished author and playwright. This story is simply called Nightlight, and it stars Baz Cameron as Richard, Ben Abramson as Michael, and Barb Tyler as the narrator. And be sure to not turn off your lights for this story. Again, I repeat, do not turn off your lights. Lights on.
It's Friday evening, and the Browns are entertaining friends. From his bedroom at the top of the stairs, 6-year-old Michael listens to the sounds of the party. He can hear soft voices and laughter, music droning in the background and ice cubes tinkling in highball glasses. The sounds are reassuring, comforting. They make him believe downstairs everything is normal, because upstairs it is not. Michael glances at his brother, who is sleeping in the other bed. Richard is 14 and has his own room, but he's staying with Michael because his room is being painted. He sprawled on top of the covers, one leg dragging on the floor.
Richard, Richard, are you sleeping?
I was, Dimwit. What do you want?
Michael frowns. Something is in their bedroom, something small and fierce. How it got there, he isn't sure, but it's been sitting in the corner for 2 hours now, watching them. It's being very quiet. It thinks it's being smart. But Michael can hear its teeth click. He fixes his gaze on the bedroom door, which his mother has left partially open. Light from the hall is filtering into the room, but it only graces Richard's bed. Michael's bed is dark, except for a splash glowing on his headboard. He inches his way into it and draws his knees up under his chin.
What are you doing, stupid? Do you think that peony light is going to save you? That stuff only works in the movies.
Maybe. Look, you can see it now. It's out of the corner. It crawled up on my toy box.
Richard rises and squints into the darkness, but after a moment he falls back.
There's nothing in the dark that wasn't there in the light.
He stares at his brother for a moment and then swings his legs out of bed.
What are you doing?
What do you think I'm going to do? I'm turning off the light. I got to get some sleep. I have a swim meet tomorrow.
No. Wait. Richard, don't. Please.
The panic in his little brother's voice stops Richard. He shakes his head with impatience, but forces his voice to soften.
Look, this is silly. The dark isn't so bad. You just have to get used to it.
Michael casts a skeptical glance at the something. It looks a lot like one of the bad gremlins from that movie, he thinks. It has big eyes and pointy teeth and a wide, nasty grin. It's humming to itself while it makes spitballs out of construction paper.
How long did it take you? How long did it take you to get used to the dark?
I don't know. One night, maybe two. Not long.
Michael nods. His brother is lying, but he's touched by the unexpected kindness. Richard, he knows, was never afraid of the dark. He's like their father, big-boned and brash. He believes in batting averages and baseball scores and the integrity of numbers. Michael wishes he was more like his father than his mother, who is a reader and worrier and often cries in her sleep.
Well, what's it going to be? Lights on or off?
Michael hesitates. He can hear the something chuckling in the darkness. It thinks it has already won the night.
Please?
Jeez Louise.
Richard sighs. He grabs a blanket and a pillow from his bed and stumbles into the hall.
Okay, have it your way. Keep the lights on. But I'm out of here. I'll sleep in my room with the paint cans.
No, wait, Richie, please. We'll work something out.
Like what? Either lights on or it's off. There's no middle ground.
Yes, there is.
No, there isn't.
Yes, there is. I know there is.
There is a pause. Richard was all the way down the hall, but Michael can hear him shuffling back. He grins as he peers into the room.
Why, Mickey, I'm surprised at you. You want to switch beds, don't you? You want to switch beds so your something can get me instead of you.
Michael sits up stiffly.
No. Jeez, Richie. I'd never do that. I never even thought of that.
Really? The idea hasn't crossed your little infant brain?
No, I never. Well, I mean, I thought of it, but...
Aha! I was right. My little brother isn't so nice. He wants to feed me to his monster. Thanks a lot, kiddo. I'll remember that at Christmas.
Tears of frustration flood Michael's eyes.
No, Richie, that isn't it. That isn't it at all.
It isn't?
No, the something doesn't care what bed you're in. It isn't after you.
Why not? Does it think I'm too tough?
Michael sighs.
Tonight has more to do with eyesight than with toughness. But he doesn't want to argue the point.
Yes, something like that.
Richard rubs his eyes. He's not a cruel boy, just a tired one. Given a choice, he'd rather sleep in a bed than the floor.
So, if we do this switching thing, will you stop bugging me?
Michael bobs his head.
What about tomorrow?
It won't be back tomorrow.
How do you know?
Michael glances at the something. It has stopped making spitballs. It's just sitting there, clicking its teeth. But it's starting to get anxious.
It won't be back tomorrow.
He says, wondering why he knows this.
Tonight's its only night here.
Geez, you really are nuts.
Richard groans, but he doesn't leave. He stumbles into the room, drops his blanket back on the bed, and then grabs Michael and dumps him on top of the blanket.
You owe me big time, little bro.
He growls as he flops on Michael's bed.
Very big time.
And he pulls the sheet over his face. Michael wraps the blanket around him and snuggles into the light. He can hear the something grumbling as it paces on top of the toy box. It knows it has been tricked, and it is angry.
Go away! You can't get me here! Why don't you quit and just go home?
The something glares at him crossly, but it doesn't leave.
Suit yourself, but I'm going to sleep.
And smiling, he rolls over, turning his face to the light. When the first spitball hits him, he cries out more in surprise than in pain, even though he can feel the welt rising from the burn on his cheek.
Hey!
He cries and sits up frantically, brushing the spitball to the floor. It makes a little hissing sound when it reaches the rug, and Michael watches its glow fade into a small scorch hole in the rug.
Hey, what are you trying to do? Start a fire?
Apparently, this was the creature's intent, because in the next instant, a barrage of paper missiles descends on the child's head. Michael manages to block most of them with Richard's blanket, but one spitball does find the floor again. It starts to flare on the rug, but Michael douses it with some leftover fruit juice from a glass his mother brought him at bedtime.
It's stupid to start a fire,
Michael says to the something. It has retreated to the toy box and is making more spitballs.
The firemen will come and put it out, and there'll be lots of noise and lights.
Michael glances at the Superman clock on the wall. Its luminous face shows that it's 10 o'clock.
Only 2 hours before midnight, and then it's tomorrow. Maybe it's time to rethink.
Rethink is one of his father's favorite words. Michael tries to lower his voice so he sounds more like his father.
Maybe. You should trust someone else. Someone who doesn't have a nightlight.
The something doesn't answer. It doesn't talk, of course. It believes actions are better than words, but Michael can tell it's thinking. He peers into the darkness. He can see the something's eyes, but just barely. They're glowing on top of the toy box. He thinks he sees the creature smile, but he isn't sure. And then the smile fades and disappears.
Hello? Are you there?
Nothing. Michael peers under his bed.
Hey, where did you go?
He asks, but there are no rustles or clicks or laughing. He sits up puzzled and rubs his cheek. Huh, had it really been that easy? He looks about the room, but he can tell there's nothing bad in it now. It's as it always was. A little boy's room with posters on the walls and a floor strewn with clothes and toys. He waits another minute, though, just to be sure, and then he slips out of bed and tiptoes into the hallway. Richard lifts his head as Michael patters past.
Hey, dimwit, what are you up to now?
Nothing. I'm turning off the hall light.
What about your something?
It's gone.
Michael says he has to stand on tiptoe to flick off the light, and then he patters back to bed.
I told it to go away, and it did.
How do you know? Maybe it's not really gone. Maybe it's just fooling you. Maybe it's hiding. Maybe it's under your bed waiting to tickle your toes.
He stops. His brother hasn't heard a word he said. He's already asleep and dreaming. Richard flops down in disgust. He's wide awake now, his body rumbling and restless. He punches his pillow and tries to get comfortable, but he can't relax. He can hear the party noises downstairs, and he doesn't fall asleep until the guests go home and his parents come up to bed. Then at 2 o'clock, the scream awakes him. Richard sits up. It was his mother who called out, but he isn't really concerned. Her nights are often plagued with dreams, and if it's a bad one, his father will take care of it. He sits there waiting for the usual sounds to follow. His father's voice rumbling words of comfort, his mother's soft laugh of embarrassment. He waits for coughs, for sighs, for whispers, even another scream, but nothing more comes from the room. So after a while, he stops waiting. Heart pounding, Richard eases himself down in his bed. He will wait until morning before he knocks on his parents' door. Maybe he'll tell them what happened, and they'll all have a good laugh. "You thought what?" his father will ask. "You thought what?" Richard rolls over and closes his eyes. Push come to shove, his little brother is right. Some things are faced better in the daylight.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Nightlight, written and directed by Barb Tyler. And now, The Telltale Heart, a short story by Edgar Allan Poe, first published in 1843. It is told by an unnamed narrator who endeavors to convince the reader of his sanity while describing a horrible, simply horrible deed that he has done. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am, and why will you say I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived it haunted me day and night. Object there was none. Passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing, but you should have seen me. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night about midnight I turned the latch of this door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed, closed, that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work, for it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he has passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night just at 12 I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on steadily, steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening and the old man sprang up in bed crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. Presently I heard a slight groan and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or grief, oh no. It was the low stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just as midnight, when all the world slept, it has welled up from my own bosom, deepening with its dreadful echo the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. I cannot imagine, you cannot imagine, how stealthily, stealthily, until at length a simple, dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot out the crevice and fell full upon the vulture eye. It was open. Wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow of my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct, precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury, as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous, and so I am. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leapt into the room. He shrieked once, only once. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer, and I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the boards so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered 3 men who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled, for what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search well. I led them at length to his chamber. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears, but still they sat and still chattered. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I rose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Almighty God, no, no. They heard. They suspected. They knew. They were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I might scream or die. And now, again, hard, louder, 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 louder. Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here it is, the beating of his hideous heart.
I am so pleased that you are still with us, that you have remained awake and have, and this is the most important thing, that you have kept your lights on, all of them. And yes, even the one down there in your basement, the one under the stairs. This has been the 75th live broadcast of the WGTD Radio Theater in this, our 9th season. Our stars today were, in Ambrose Bierce's The Middle Toe of the Right Foot, John Oleksy, Terry Myers, and Steve Dundas, who made his debut as a member of the 91.1 Players. Vicky Dumais directed this episode. Starring in Nightlight, written by Barb Tyla, a founding member of the 91.1 Players, were Baz Spencer, and our youngest and newest member of the 91.1 Players, Ben Abramson. The narrator and director for Nightlight was Barb Tyla. And finally, The Telltale Heart, written by the wonderful writer Edgar Allan Poe, starred Siegfried Christoph, who appeared today as Vincent Price throughout our broadcast. Vicky Dumais was our director for this heart-pounding story. Barb Tyla provided all of our live sound effects, and Steve Brown was our music and sound editor and engineer. Special thanks to WGTD General Manager David Cole and to Dr. Brian Albrecht, President of Gateway Technical College. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha law firm of Aaliyah, Dumais, Dunn, and McTernan, and also the not-for-profit Brown Ostrup Performing Arts Foundation located in Salem, Wisconsin. The executive producers of the WGTD Radio Theater are Mike Ostrup and Steve Brown. Be sure to join us on Saturday, November 16th at 11:15 when we present The Cane Shadow and It's the Professor in a live broadcast once again from the beautiful Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, Wisconsin. For the WGTD Radio Theater and the 91.1 Players, thank you so much for listening.